For FM, we continue with our new book of the week. Doubling Back is the author Linda Cracknell's account of walking in the footsteps of others. In today's episode, Bearing Our Souls, Linda takes an unusual walk with her friend in Kenya. The reader is Teresa Gallagher.
Ndumberi Village, Kiambu County, Central Kenya. "Are you on strike?" a man called after us. He gave us an excuse to pause while we laughed and shook our heads. Philo and I had arrived in her village by car, wearing sunglasses and clutching at mobile phones that linked us to faster worlds in Nairobi and beyond. Now our shoes were off and we were walking gingerly, exposing ourselves to good-humoured curiosity. I first met Philo Ikonya in Senegal in 2007, at a conference of the international organisation PEN, which unites writers in a concern with freedom of expression. We coincided while out for morning walks, and discovered common ground as we talked of writing and human rights and our lives. Her fierce intelligence and humour danced through memorable talk that made sisters of us, despite the difference in our backgrounds. It was while still in Senegal that we planned to walk together around the village where Philo grew up, but we decided only today to go barefoot, for simple pleasure and to see what meaning we could draw from the sensations. The man's question about us striking was not surprising. Exactly a year before, in 2007, disastrous elections had resulted in violence that left over 1,000 people dead, thousands injured, and some 300,000 displaced. The growing of maize was disrupted, leading to a famine, and now a major scandal was erupting as maize imported to alleviate the situation had reportedly been sold to South Sudan. A shaky coalition government was setting the streets murmuring with discontent, and all secondary school teachers were on strike. We'd seen them marching barefoot in several places on our travels, waving branches above their heads. It was a long time since I'd walked barefoot anywhere except on a beach, but I was willing to try. Philo had told me that women and girls all go barefoot on these village paths. The rainy season transforms the hard red earth into a clogging swamp, and shoes are completely impractical. But for me, and for my friends used to wearing shoes in Nairobi streets, it was strange and difficult. We weren't going far. From Philo's mother's house we would walk to the river, where water was collected, to the school, where her mother taught for 30 years, and finally to Riara Church, which was so emblematic of their family life because all 10 children had been baptised there. When we met Philo's mother, Josephine Wambui Ikonya, her feet had looked strong, lying parallel beneath her on the tiled floor of her house. They were shapely, with a slightly bluish-grey hue, the left one still bruised and swollen where a rock had fallen on it the week before. Nevertheless, they suggested confidence in themselves. The hands crossed on her lap were wide and workish on the slim wrists of a woman so small that when she stood up she barely reached my chest. They were hands that still cut maize and dug soil on the shamba, the plot where food is grown. A gallery of popes and madonnas hung from a high rail and was spread on an altar-like table, along with photos of the family. As we walked out into the lush garden of broad banana leaves, Philo pointed out the graves of a number of family members, including several children. We'd already seen a photo of Philo's brother, Peter, at his graduation from Northern Alberta Institute of Science and Technology, who had died aged only 35. She told me a little of him, and how the two often walked these village paths together. Affection and loss animated her description of his distinctive footprint. It was inherited through her mother's family, who she said walked with amazing feet. Philo described the shape of the heel as a zero, with an arch so high that the foot didn't meet the ground again until the next little zero at the ball, and the dot, dot, dot of the toes. She would know his footprint anywhere, she said, printed onto the earth paths radiating from the house, layered now under the marks of more recent walkers. At first, our feet reflexed away from the ground in fear of sharp pebbles that cars had scrambled up. Neighbours hailed our small sisterly procession as we crept onwards. Philo was well known to the village people. She not only grew up here, but had stood for Parliament in this constituency the previous year. She was famous for her grassroots activism, for hard-hitting journalism attacking corruption and injustice. During the worst days of unrest in 2008, she'd walked the streets of Nairobi wearing a sackcloth to draw attention to the plight of her beloved country. The people of Kiambu knew Philo had promised miracles if she was elected, an education that would allow them to stand on their own two feet and thereby ensure access to shelter, food, clothing and medicine. But, they said as they smiled us past, look at her powers now. She can even make a white woman walk without shoes. Abandoning the road for a narrow path to our left, we dropped steeply into a valley through a high corridor of foliage. Our feet padded silently on the soil, still damp and cool with the memory of last week's rain. Up on a ridge, a gateway opened into the primary school where Philo's mother had worked. I picked my way through dumped rubble. Philo looked around at the single-story, brick-built classrooms, grills at the windows clinging onto shards of broken glass, the doors swinging open. She wanted to know what had happened since she'd last come. Why one of the classrooms was condemned? What should be done? I sensed one of her campaigns developing. We moved through another gate and met the plain face of Riara Church. Solid, tall and white. The alcoves of its circular and arched windows were edged in pale turquoise. A novice invited us into the garden of Father Julius's house, where we rested in a gazebo amidst ornamental shrubs and the scent of rosemary. The young man wore a sweatshirt from the old Macca Academy in Aberdeen, with its motif of three fishes and a tower, one of those strange folds in geography that carry a hint of home. Philo then recalled a blind Scotsman, Father Wallace, who used to walk from here. If challenged on it, he would always refute that he was alone, saying he was walking with his great friend, the Holy Ghost. In turn, we washed our feet under the garden tap. The red soil streamed away, the water cooled hot soles, gilded our feet with sunlight. We put on our shoes again. My soles tingled, and as we started back, my gait was shifted by the elevation from the ground. A new perspective, a sense perhaps closed off, but I felt deeply refreshed. On our return, we found Philo's mother sitting on her sofa, hands folded, strong feet still firmly planted. I showed her the photographs I'd taken. What memories we'd be able to have with photos such as these, she said. We looked at her wedding photo. She was 20, seated in a white satin dress with tiny cap sleeves. On her lap, those calm hands held flowers. Her face, the dark points of her deep-set eyes, were completely recognizable 60 years on. Her husband stood next to her in a white suit, as handsome as she was beautiful. A slight nervousness betrayed by the uneven weight on his feet. I wondered about her feet, whether in the contours and cracks of the skin, her soles would reveal a map in miniature of the ways we'd just taken, the well-worn routes between home and river, home and workplace, home and church. Philo was excited when we met the next day. Having seen how our walk attracted attention and how we'd felt so energized by it, she'd made some phone calls. A group of writers and activists would walk barefoot through Nairobi. Their feet would write a protest at this important time in Kenya's history. In mid-February, before their walk happened, I returned to a Scotland locked into a ferocious cold snap. Impacted boot prints radiated out from the town where I live, etching into deep snow an archive of journeys made by dog walkers over several days. I thought of the red dust paths of Philo's village, worn by successive generations. As I walked and read and settled back to a comfortable winter melancholy, I thought back over my experiences in Kenya. We'd visited Kisumu in the west and celebrated in Obama's village, Kogelo, on the day of his presidential inauguration. We'd hoped to sell the book that Philo had written for young readers about Obama's Kenyan origins. We spent the day surrounded by children, and often adults, devouring the pages of the book. But it was unthinkable for any of these country folk to buy a copy, or even get access to one to borrow. A situation reflected all over sub-Saharan Africa, where any available books, even in school libraries, are so precious they might be wrapped in plastic and kept on a shelf rather than read. And I remembered Inepefre, Scotland's first public lending library, set on a bend of the River Erne in Perthshire. Founded in 1680, it epitomises Scotland's enlightenment and a belief in the power of books to civilise and democratise, to illuminate the spirit. Its use by local people, stonemasons, maids, dyers, who walked miles to reach the library, reflected a passion for learning. Then an urgent email arrived from a member of PEN, Kenya. Philo had been arrested during a peaceful protest outside Parliament. Her hands had been raised in empty maize packets to highlight the hunger of ordinary Kenyans brought about through corruption. News trickled in over the hours. She was in a police cell. She was in court. She was in hospital following her brutal treatment by the police. Then she was home and safe. Immediately after release and before sleep, she posted her experience on her blog, including the stories of women she met in the cells, who had less leverage to be fairly treated, raising her voice for the voiceless. One detail particularly saddened me. As she was moved by the police from station to cell to court, provoked with punches, verbal abuse, threats, as she was walked between cars, cells and interview rooms, with keys shaken, heavy bolts drawn on dark rooms with light bulbs that didn't work, the police had taken away her shoes. She was barefoot. My own feet still recalled our walk. Some of the toughened skin was peeling off in a translucent film grained with contours. It's one thing to love to walk village paths barefoot, Philo wrote in an email afterwards. Another to be forced to step on cold cement. Our feet celebrations turned into tears. She compared it to the humiliation of being stripped. There were verbal threats too, insinuations, the most vicious part of the treatment. When one of the policemen said, "Madam, do you know how you will die?" She answered, "Yes, surrounded by books, in my bed, with people that love me." The police released her with only one shoe. The day after leaving hospital, she walked back across the city barefoot and defiant, carrying the one remaining shoe to demand its pair at the police station. Showing shock in their faces, people stopped to ask her if she was protesting about something. "Yes," she said. This time, she was.
And Teresa Gallagher continues her reading of Doubling Back by Linda Cracknell at the same time tomorrow. The book is abridged by Sian Preece and produced by Gena McFarlane. And if you enjoy walking, then join us on Thursday afternoons at 3 on Radio 4 when we go rambling with Claire Balding.
What we want to create is an atmosphere whereby people can really talk honestly and openly about their experiences.
I didn't have that moment when I thought enough was enough.
We've talked to people who have survived a near-death experience. We've also talked to people who've fallen off the wagon.
Well, maybe I'll try Cinzano. Or maybe I'll try Blue Nun.
Good Lord, woman.
I know, exactly. That was desperate measures.
Someone say something.
Fee Glover presents a new series of Shared Experience on BBC Radio 4, beginning this afternoon at 3:30.